Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Your hosts for today are Susan Franzen and Gina McAndrews. Welcome to both of you.
We are both happy to be together for a program that is a fitting encore to Black History Month and an introduction to Iowa History Month and a preview of the Iowa Sesquicentennial. But let's start with two ISU professors who are familiar with the 1619 Project and can explain a historian's response to House File 222, sponsored by Representative Skylar Wheeler, Republican, Orange City, which would ban schools, colleges, and Regents institutions from incorporating the 1619 Project or, quote, any similarly developed curriculum, unquote, in U.S. history classes, and would take away state aid from institutions that use it. To find out what this all means, we have invited Amy Rutenberg, an Iowa State University Assistant Professor of History and Social Studies, as well as Brian Bankin, Iowa State University History and African American Studies Professor, to tell us about it. Thank you for being with us today, Amy and Brian. Welcome to you both.
And tell us why you are here to talk about 1619.
My name is Amy Rutenberg. I'm an assistant professor of history at Iowa State, and I also coordinate the secondary social studies education program. So I teach future teachers, and I also used to be a high school teacher.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for having me. My name is Brian Bankin. I'm an associate professor also in the Department of History at Iowa State. I have a joint appointment in history and Latino studies, and then I have an affiliate or courtesy faculty appointment in the African and African American Studies program. So a lot of the subjects that are in the 1619 Project, I actively teach in my classes, especially my African American history classes.
For those who may not know about this bill, House File 220, sponsored by Representative Skylar Wheeler from Orange City, it states that schools, colleges, and Regents institutions should not be allowed to incorporate the 1619 Project or any similarly developed curriculum. What that would mean isn't specific. In U.S. history classes, and would take away state aid from any institutions that use it. I thought this was pretty shocking from a historical perspective as well as any other. And so I did go online and research a little bit and found out that this is a subcommittee, and there are just three members of the subcommittee. Two are from Northwest Iowa, the Republicans. And they both voted to advance the bill. And the Democrat, of course, voted against it. But it hasn't gone very far. They're not going to vote this year and next year. They probably will have forgotten about it. But it certainly caused attention to a very valuable issue. So I guess I'll start by asking you, Brian, to describe what is the 1619 Project.
Yeah, I'm happy to. I know Amy can as well. So the 1619 Project is one that just came out August of last year. It was an initiative project done by the New York Times. The whole idea is 1619 is the first documented, so it's the first that we know, arrival of African people in the North American continent. So at that time in English North America. That's roughly a decade after the founding of Jamestown, and so it's pretty close to the beginning of the founding of the Virginia colony. And in essence, what the project was doing was not only commemorating the arrival of those 20 or so African people, some of whom were enslaved, we believe, some of whom were made into indentured servants and then potentially freed at some point, some of whom we just don't know really what happened to them. It's sort of a big question mark. you know, they wanted to forefront the arrival of those people as this really important demarcation, if you will, in American history, and take the arrival of Black people back to the founding, if you will, of what would eventually become the United States of America. You know, there's a critique, if you will, in African American history, and I think we've actually just seen this. We actually see it just about every February with Black History Month, where the African American experience in the United States is basically reduced to either slavery or the civil rights struggle. And at least in part, the authors of the 1619 Project, and they were very open and very clear about that. They wanted to kind of reframe that understanding of the Black experience, taking it back to the founding of Jamestown and the English colonies. So that's really kind of the genesis, marking that anniversary. Nicole Hannah Jones, in her introductory essay, made some of that stuff very clear. And then all of the authors, you know, basically offered either new interpretations or interpretations of the African-American experience that have been consistent with how scholars have been teaching Black history going back at least the past two decades and probably longer than that. And I'll stop there and see if Amy wants to add anything.
I think the only thing that our listeners might be interested in knowing is that 1619 is 2 years before the Pilgrims landed in Massachusetts. So the notion that people of African descent have been part of American history from the very beginning is key here, because they were in fact here before the Pilgrims.
Well, one of the things that's valuable about this curriculum is that it is a curriculum, that a teacher who wants to teach these kinds of subjects hasn't been trained to go where to look. And of course, most teachers are extraordinarily busy anyhow, usually teaching three or four different preparations, at least, if they're high school teachers. Or could you comment on some of the materials that are available through this curriculum?
Sure. So they have been put out through an independent organization called the Pulitzer Center, which designs curriculum, generally speaking, around journalism and media literacy. And a lot of the curriculum actually for the 1619 Project is decently similar in that it takes the insert that was the 1619 Project in the New York Times when it was released, and breaks down the stories and the presentations that are part of the 1619 Project. It asks students to think critically about not only the content of the various articles, but also the imagery, the videos that have accompanied the 1619 Project, and to think about how we construct history. There are actually within the curriculum a number of lessons that ask students to think about who are the historians, how do we decide what events are important or defined as history. I find it actually a very interesting, well done curriculum.
It sounds like it's valuable from many aspects. I mean,
yeah, I think so. And actually, I should be careful here, because I think that people use this term curriculum. It actually gets thrown around a lot. What the 1619 Project presents for teachers are curricular materials. A curriculum is the thing that teachers teach all year and that they come up with related to their course, whether that be U.S. history or world history or economics. Curricular materials are independent lesson plans, sometimes a group of lesson plans that can be used as part of that larger curriculum.
Yeah, I was going to actually say something very similar, because the nice thing about the material in the project is, if you want to pick, like, so for example, I was attracted to Matthew Desmond's essay on capitalism. Kevin Cruz, who's a well-known historian, wrote about traffic, and again, connecting all of these things to the Black experience. And then Brian Stevenson, who's a very well-known advocate and activist, you know, working on death penalty cases and that sort of thing, wrote a piece on mass incarceration. And so you could take, like, those are the things that I like. I could take those if I wanted to and insert them into my class, but I don't have to teach the whole thing because it's not a curriculum all by itself. And I think, you know, as Amy was saying, that's really one of the beauties or the benefits of it is, you know, you don't like that particular part or it's not really in your wheelhouse and you don't want to get into it. You don't deal with it, but you maybe pull the things out that you like and you want students to better understand. You want students to grapple with that. That's, you know, that's one of the things about this kind of project. It got some criticism. Some of it was, you know, came from a handful of historians who didn't like some of the factual and conceptualization of the project. Some of the criticism was frankly unwarranted and was silly and was just a reaction, I think, to fronting or centering Black people in the American experience. And I think that's where this legislation is coming from, is that either assumption that this is just new and somehow revisionism and that sort of thing. And revisionism in certain circles is seen as this really bad, negative thing. And of course, that's really what we do all day long as historians. We think about how are we going to better understand the past and ergo, how are we going to revise what we know now? You know, and I don't know, this type of legislation, I want to use the word clever, I guess, because it doesn't actually ban. I mean, that's what it's trying to do, but it doesn't actually ban the use of this material. It says if you're basically busted using it, then you're going to, you know, see your institution receive some type of cut in funding, which, you know, for a lot of institutions will convince them, I think, not to ever teach that particular material. And, you know, I don't know. I prefer to live in a country where we don't ban books, where we don't silence people's rights, where we don't, you know, take away democratic choice. Where we don't do those things. You know, I would hope we're not a book burning country. And this is not a book, but it seems like a very similar, you know, similar thing to me.
Well, it actually, when I talked to you earlier and you mentioned the podcasts, which are available to everybody, the Pulitzer Committee put them out online. You can just see the podcast. Anybody can. So basically what this has done is publicize the 1619 project. So anybody who's curious about it or says, you know, how did they do that? Can just go online and find it, right? Or find a reading list, whatever they want to do. So it's perhaps a little the opposite of what the... By the way, I looked on the website, the state's website, and there were 123 comments, 120 strongly negative comments about this bill, and two that said that the bill was good because it would unite people. I didn't understand that. And then one person that said, oh, this is a fraud, but it should be taught because it'll create a chance for critical thinking. So basically, one way or another, there's some discussion of history that people need to be doing.
The comment about uniting people speaks to a larger question of how folks understand United States history and believe it should be taught. And there is a cohort of people who argue that history like that contained within the 1619 Project is somehow negative because it is identity politics and divides people. And that is in stark contrast to another cohort of people who believe that we should be teaching American history as a patriotic uniting project. And so that pointing out places where people have acted like people in all of their positives and negatives is somehow harmful to our students and our country. From a historical point of view, wearing my historian hat, that is of course absurd. And then speaking wearing my teacher hat, I think that our job as teachers is in fact to teach our students critical thinking and to understand how we have gotten to the place where we are. And that cannot be done without acknowledging that history is complex, that people are complex, and that students need to grapple with the contradictions that exist in our past. So that I think explains a little bit of what you were seeing, Susan.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I can just add really quickly to that. You know, one of the things that we do is certainly as scholars, we find and report facts. You know, we find factual information. We find new factual information all the time. And so there's this conception, and I think Amy's making this point quite nicely, that history is this, I don't know, it's this thing, this pie in the sky, if you will, that you can't touch it and mess with it because, you know, it's sacred or something like that. And especially the history of our country, you know, there are folks that have that kind of thinking. And that's just, like, it's not really true because, A, those facts are oftentimes complicated when we find new factual information. And that, at least for me, and I think Amy would agree with me, as historians, that's really what makes history interesting, is how do I maybe find this thing that's new or find this thing that comes from a voice. And again, that's one of the things that the 1619 Project does well. It provides voice, you know, to a particular field in American history. How do we take that information and integrate it? How do we debate it and talk about it and have a conversation? And you know, one of the things that historians are, some of us are good at, some of us are not so good at, is arguing with each other. You know, we sometimes have fairly vicious fights. Sometimes we have very positive and usually I'm going to say mostly positive and constructive fights. So we get to a better understanding and a final, you know, sort of, we're doing a publication, a final project there. And, you know, you can't do that if you're shutting down debate. You know, you can't have that conversation with your students, with your colleagues, with, you know, a person in the public. If you're saying, if someone's saying, like, you literally can't talk about that. And in fact, what we would rather have you talk about is this 1776 commission report, which, as far as scholarship is concerned, is, you know, is about the lamest and weakest that you're going to read. And you'd be hard pressed to read it now because the website was shut down as soon as Trump was out of office. But, you know, we can't, Amy and I can't really operate in that kind of environment. And we certainly can't teach our students to be good critical thinkers when we're being told we can't actually talk about things.
Full disclosure, I once taught college history, I mean, college level history, and I was badly prepared because when I was in high school, I took a really good American history class when I was in the eighth grade or something, and I loved it, and I loved the teacher. And then when I was a senior, I took American history again, and it was exactly the same material. Exactly. So I thought, well, I've done American history. And I literally never took a survey course again, which really was bad when I had to teach it. But what I was discovering, this was the year of Wounded Knee, the standoff at Wounded Knee. So I started reading things like Bury My Heart, Wounded Knee, and a lot of
Native American history.
And what I was reading was so shocking. And I thought, how can I teach my students these things that they should really be ashamed of? How can I say, be proud of your country? Look what they did. I mean, and, you know, as people are saying that, you know, we don't want to teach any Black history. I said, okay, let's talk about Native Americans. Let's talk about the Chinese. You know, how do you teach history that, and you'd say, okay, we did a lot of bad things.
But I think that part of what needs to be said here, because talking about, oh, I'm not proud of my country, oh, we should be proud of our country, I think that sets up a really false dichotomy, and I'm very uncomfortable with it because it plays right into the culture war pieces. Our country is complex. People in our past have done amazing things. People in our past have done terrible things. But I think that actually one of the main points of the 1619 Project is to say that the ideals of the Declaration of Independence and our other founding documents, the ideal that all people are created equal and that all people have certain inalienable rights, that's an incredibly powerful ideal. It is not an ideal that was realized in 1619. It's not an ideal that was realized in 1776, and it's not an ideal that has been realized in 2021. But people have done incredible work. They've put their lives on the line. They have marched. They have died in the name of those ideals to make them real. And the fact that people are willing to do that in our country, who are Americans, that is something to be proud of. And that is something to acknowledge and to learn about and to ask questions about and to reinterpret our history to include. Because that's where the power comes from. That's what makes and can make America a great place. Right. And I think that talking about, oh, well, one way unites us and one way tears us apart, that's not what history is. That does not reflect reality. It doesn't reflect reality in the past. It doesn't reflect reality in our classrooms. And so, you know, I just think it's a false question.
Yeah. And you know, if you're looking for that pride thing, right, if history is supposed to be about, you know, making you feel proud or whatnot, you're not really studying history. You know, it's more propaganda or something along those lines. You know, the design of history is not necessarily to make you feel a certain kind of way. It's to, you know, it's to better understand the past and to maybe use that to guide the present. You know, Susan, you said something that I find my students say all the time, and I'll go back and I know Amy and her colleague Jeff Grimmer have been working really hard on this, and that is to get their students to have a much better understanding of history from the perspective of diverse communities. But one of the most common things that my students tell me in my Latino studies or African American history classes or whatever it might be is, why am I just now learning about this? You know, why has it taken me to get to college? And I think in part, you know, they're describing, Susan, the experience that you had, you know, some...
Yeah, you don't need to say how many years ago.
Some decades ago, yes. And, you know, and you said something else, you know, you used the word we, right? And that's one of the things that my students do as well. And I'm like, who's the we that we're talking about? Because we today are much different than the we who were the American people, you know, 250 years ago. My hearing of that, it always tickles my ear, but it makes for a really useful conversation with my students, because usually what they mean by we is white people. And part of getting them to understand that parts of American history don't necessarily have that we either, because they're unknown or they were excluded, is really, really important. You know, understanding history not from a, this is how I understand it, as what white people did to a certain group, but rather what that group's experience was, trying to put yourselves in the yourself in the shoes of those people. You know, that's really difficult, but it's also really, really necessary. And again, I think that's one of the things that the 1619 Project and trying to front end and trying to make it very, very clear, you know, this is how we're trying to understand the African-American perspective and trying to, you know, forefront that and that sort of thing. I mean, that's what makes it so very important, because it really does, I think, attempt to get people to think about things in a different way. And because it's the New York Times, and you know, Amy made this point really clear early on, and you did as well, right? Sometimes these bills are actually drawing attention to a project. There are only so many people that Amy and I are going to reach in our classrooms, right? There are only so many people who are going to read, you know, our books and our articles. We don't have the reach. You know, two PhDs here on this Zoom call. We don't have the reach that a New York Times does. And so having that ability to push this information out actually is really, really important.
There's a historian named Daniel Immerwahr, who wrote a wonderful piece for the Washington Post that talks about the purposes of history, that talks about why are we treating this field so differently from all the rest. We don't teach children in an algebra class to love or hate angles. We teach them the Pythagorean theorem. So why are we approaching American history curriculum as something that they should love or they should hate, or the past as something that they should love or they should hate? Rather, why are we not just teaching them history? And exactly what Brian was saying is what history is. It's what we should be teaching them. The tapestry that is the American experience, and to trouble that and to think about it, and who gets to create the narratives that we consider important and the narratives that get jettisoned or pushed to the side. And 1619 is part of a larger historical project to pull different voices toward the center. And as Brian says, its power is in the fact that it was in the New York Times and that it was public and that, you know, it's written not just for teachers, but for people.
Thank you. I appreciate your coming on and giving some publicity to this very valuable perspective.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
In ending our encore to Black History Month, we'll hear the famous poem by Langston Hughes, which has been set to music and is now considered the Black National Anthem. Lift every voice and sing.
I like this part right here. Come on.
Sing a song full of the faith that the dark past has taught us. Sing a song full of the hope that the present has brought us. Facing the
add a little something to it. Just to encourage you. We're going to take you to church later. Let's go!
We'll keep marching right until the victory is won.
To all my brothers out there.
Hold your head up, brother, till the victory is won.
To all my sisters in the struggle.
Keep believing, sister, till the victory is won.
Till that day.
Till that day comes.
Hey.
Let us march on.
To victory.
Till victory.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we have spent the first part of our program in an encore of African American History Month by discussing House Bill 222, dealing with harsh financial punishments for using teaching materials from the 1619 Project. Our guests have been Brian Benkin and Amy Rutenberg from the ISU History Department, explaining why they believe it is an important addition to the curriculum and what the purpose of teaching history is. As we leave this topic, we would like to add the voice of an icon from popular culture who has something to say about the importance of understanding and acting on historical knowledge. Stevie Wonder has sold over 100 million records worldwide, making him one of the best-selling music artists of all time. But he is also noted for his work as an activist for political causes, including his 1980 campaign to make Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday a federal holiday in the United States. In 2009, he was named United Nations Messenger of Peace. In 2014, he was honored with the Presidential Medal of Freedom. In 2021, he made this speech in an open letter to Dr. King.
Dear Dr. King, I met you when I was 14 years of age. You were a true hero and you became an inspiration. I've been blessed to write songs of love, hope, and motivation, many of them inspired by your life. More than any award that I've ever received, I want you to know that I'm thankful how you influenced my place of love, which allowed me to try to push the needle of love and equality forward. It is painful to know that needle has not moved one iota. For 36 years, we've had a national holiday honoring your birthday and principles, yet you would not believe the lack of progress. It makes me physically sick. I am sick that politicians try to find an easy solution to a 400-year problem. I am sick of some people using God for a convenience rather than a commitment. I am sick of lies and deceit that dominate our reality. I am sick that truth is struggling to be heard and defended. What we say has not been what we do. And this country must reconcile our words and deeds until we turn our mouth movement into righteous action. We're doing our nation, God, in your memory, an injustice. Until what we say is what we do, there is no truth. It is just repeating and rewriting history, just as we have for the last 400 years. We must define the truth in the facts that support them and declare them absolute. Those who promote lies and false truth must be held accountable. It is the only way we can move forward. It is time to formally seek the truth and formally declare facts. We need a truth commission that forces this country to look at its lies. I'm calling on President Biden and Vice President Harris to launch a formal government investigation to establish the truth of inequality in this country. This truth will validate the history, and this commission will recommend reconciliation. Without truth, we cannot have accountability. Without accountability, we cannot have forgiveness. Without forgiveness, we cannot heal. It is time for all to take the only stand. We cannot be afraid to confront a lie and a liar. Those in leadership who won't or don't acknowledge the truth should be held accountable. Dr. King, these times require courage, as they did when you lived and paid the ultimate price. On this day, a day in your honor, I pledge to have the courage to say what I see and acknowledge what I hear. In your spirit, I call on all those in the Senate to speak truth to what they know they can physically see, and begin the steps of accountability, forgiveness, and then healing. With a heavy heart and a hopeful spirit, Dr. King, I am Stevie.
This is KHOI Community Radio. Story City, Ames, and Gina McAndrews, and I have been speaking with Brian Benkin and Amy Rutenberg about the 1619 Project. It's time to turn to the activities of the Iowa Historical Society with programs, many of which you can sign up to participate virtually by going to their website, which you can Google at Iowa History Month. And it's a lot more than a month of programs. You could also find it on our website. And it includes a book club that has wonderful books that you can either listen to, you can join with others as you would at a book club and discuss the books, I presume. They'll have a presentation of the book. And in some cases, they'll have the authors. But to launch the Iowa Sesquicentennial properly, we have our guest host, Paul Wearson, with us, who will help us learn some things about Iowa history that aren't on the Historical Society website. Hi, Paul.
Hello, Paul.
Hi, how are you?
And
hi, Tina, how are you?
Good, good, good. Excited to hear what history you're going to share with us.
Well, of course, my heritage here at Story City is built around the Norwegian heritage. Every year we have the Scandinavian Days, and in fact, every community has some sort of special event every summer. And in all the communities of Iowa, usually there's an ethnic flavor to that, because, of course, when Iowa was settled, towns tended to be built around ethnic groups. Everyone got in on the Homestead Act, and people settled the Middle West to farm. And one community would be German, one community would be Norwegian, and another community might be Dane. And this area was pretty much settled by Northern Europeans and Scandinavians. So this is our heritage here in central Iowa. And I've noticed that Susan and I took many great trips to surrounding communities. And it seems that every community, no matter how small, has a museum or a historical society. So everybody values the formation of their community, and they commemorate that by raising money, collecting all the things that might be donated by local people. There's all kinds of things, located in someone's attic that might be very significant to local history. And that's the great thing about history. We're constantly discovering new things about our own communities and our own history. Right now, the Civil War was 150 years ago. Well, we're still uncovering diaries and written material from the war that really highlights the experience of the average family or the soldier in the field or things we didn't know about before. So we think of history as being so pat and so known. And the fact is that throughout everyday life here currently, we're learning more about things we didn't know about, stuff we knew or thought we knew, and it sheds a new light on that. And the folks who were talking about the 1619 Project, well, this highlights things that have not been stressed or brought out in the past, and we really need to know that information, and that has to be shared with young people growing up, because you really have to see America and our background and our history, not only locally but nationally, in the light of truth and to see what really happened. And of course, as they pointed out, there are going to be great things accomplished by Americans and by America, and our ideals and our Constitution are unique in the history of the human race, but we're flawed also, and we have much to talk to each other about in terms of how we became a nation and who built this country and the positive and negative things about America. We need to know the whole truth, and that helps people understand the current situation. History is not useful if we don't learn from it, and if that does not influence what we do next. So basically, I'm talking about not only history is taught at the schools, but also we have history being taught locally in all our museums and historical societies scattered across Iowa. We value history, but we also need to know some of the negative sides that, some of these communities were so insular that maybe somebody in a small town would say, well, we don't go over here because those are the Germans, or the ethnic prejudices we had back in the 1800s and early 1900s about these closed ethnic communities that are much more varied today. And I notice in my own community here, there are many fewer Norwegian names on the backs of the football players. Before, back in the 50s when I grew up, most of the last names had S-O-N or S-T-A-D or some of these Scandinavian names. And I look at the backs of the football players now, and the surnames are much more varied. So it's hard to say that Story City, for instance, is a Scandinavian community. That might be our origin and our history, but certainly in the modern day, that's diluted quite a bit by the fact that a lot of other people have moved in, and that's all to the positive. We're not the closed ethnic communities we were during the settlement era and during much of the early 20th century. So history shows that America really is a melting pot, and it also informs us that since that's true, we need to know more about other people who are not part of our ethnic group, not part of our community. And that's what the 1619 Project really illustrates, because the black experience, we've sort of papered over that. You know, and when you look at the high school texts or the traditional history courses in America, slavery's mentioned and the Civil War's mentioned, but nobody goes into that in depth. And so when you tell people and let them understand that the Capitol building in Washington and the White House were built by slaves, well, that's a shock, you know. But it's just a fact that's been obscured in history by the people who wrote history, which were white men for the most part, you know. So I really think that you can even quote the scripture here. Jesus famously says that you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Well, what are we afraid of if we look back on America, warts and all, of all the positives and all the great things about the country? Kind of flavored by some of the mistakes we made. And what are mistakes for? Well, they're opportunities to learn. And that's what's part of our history, too, that we have striven to correct our mistakes. So that's, to me, what history is. It's not only a consignment to the past and forgetting things about what we don't want to think about. It's to learn from all the things we can be proud of, as well as the things that we need to work on, you know, the mistakes we need to correct, and how to behave in the future. So modern sensitivities have really changed. Just yesterday, they're taking out of publication some of the Dr. Seuss books, you know. Well, all that says is that what we used to pass off as something that isn't a bad thing, and of course I'm not condemning these books, I'm just saying that it really is a showing of how we thought back when those books were written. None of his intentions were negative, but it was the accepted persona of what an Oriental looks like, or what a black person is like, or, you know, stereotypical thinking is what we now see looking back was kind of insensitive, and probably we need to work on that. So it's not that we're canceling out of the famous cancel culture thing. It's that we're illuminating the past and looking at what we thought at that time and what we think now. And what we think now really is a product of a new sensitivity. It's about how other people are viewed, and maybe that was hurtful, and something that was a narrow vision of what our concepts of who people are should be, you know. So I think that we have growth, we have understanding, and that comes from illuminating history and then applying that to how we live today. So all of these things dovetail, and when they look at the 1619 Project, the people who are threatened by that are the people who really want propaganda taught in our schools. You know, our textbooks can't just be flag waving about America. They have to meet reality, and it's better to teach America in toto than it is to create a flag waving America wonderful text. because people need to know what we did wrong so we can correct it. And every child should have that knowledge, because many will not go on to a four-year college degree, and they need to have that information as young people. I remember in my background going to school in the late 50s, we always had Iowa history, a separate textbook for Iowa history in middle school. And we also had civics as a separate class. Well, those specializations have been taken out of the curriculum. I remember in civics class, we walked through the process of how a bill becomes law and what the function of the president is and the Supreme Court. And now that's all balled into just a few paragraphs in an overview of American history. So I wonder if we shouldn't revive some of that. And certainly, it would be nice for every state in the union to have a course in their state's history as part of their curriculum. People need to know the context in which we grew up and lived and how that affects who we are today.
Yeah, I think that's right, Paul. But I believe that one thing that people don't realize enough is that we all have our own histories. You were talking about what it's like to live in Story City. You know, it's different than living in Alcater. They have a very interesting twist on their history and their name, which is some of the things in the from the Historical Society. But Gina?
Yes.
Since Paul was talking about the Scandinavian history of Story City, you have your own history, and you sort of expanded it, didn't you?
Well, no, I quit a job out in D.C. and bought around the world tickets. I graduated, and then I worked for the Senate in Washington, D.C., for a year and a half, and I always wanted to travel, and so I just bought a ticket and went, because I figured I was just getting older, and if I didn't go, I wouldn't go. So I bought an around-the-world ticket, and I had a backpack and $450, and took off and went to 30-some countries and just picked up jobs wherever I went, milking cows or waitressing, or I worked at a Chinese restaurant. I worked at a bookbinding factory. And one of my favorites was I worked out at a cattle and sheep property out in the outback of Australia and Queensland. But yes, all the different cultures were amazing, and it was a whole world experience of realizing how, even though there's so many different people and cultures, that we're all the same, that we all want love, we want significance, we want security, we want better lives for our kids. It didn't matter if you didn't know where your food was coming. You know, I met people in rural areas of Thailand and Burma who were just fighting for a chance to vote. And I met people in Nice who had mega yachts and houses around the world and were so unhappy. It was just interesting. Some of the poorer people, or that had the less monetary wealth, were the happiest. And some of the richest people I met that had millions and millions were so miserable. And it was just quite an interesting experience. You know, everybody has a reason for what they're doing and why they're doing it that way. And that each person, whether they're in a community or as an individual, you know, families have traditions and communities have traditions, and then, you know, counties and states, and it just gets bigger and bigger. And you can break it all down to be lots of differences, but at the same time, you can really simplify it and we're all the same. You know, we celebrate our birthdays or our, you know, special occasions to us, depending on what that is. And unless we all, and none of us are perfect. And so unless we learn from our experiences and learn our history, we're stagnant. I mean, we're not going to grow, in my opinion. Like the Aboriginals in Australia, they had a storyteller in each of their villages that would, they didn't have books, they didn't have paper, but each child had to hear all these stories of the history of their people, and they had stories to take them places because there wasn't maps and there wasn't things. So they made stories, and that's how people were able to get from one section of Australia to another. And there's similar stories with, you know, Native Americans and Africa and Asia, and everybody has their stories and their histories and how stories are passed along. And unless we do pass along all the good as well as the bad, we can't grow. And growing is a significant part of living. And that's what I learned of, you know, a lot of the, whether people were rich or poor doesn't make a difference. It's if they're feeling like they're growing and they're contributing and they're part of society. So if a person just has lots of money or doesn't have any money, if they're not part of society and feel wanted and significant and feeling loved and being able to contribute, I think they're unhappy, no matter where they are or who they are.
Well, actually, you've got to the thing that I was going to talk to Paul about, because the way that Local Talk Wednesday got started was when I met Paul and I said, I can't do interviews. And he has this wonderful voice, and he's, you know, he was a pro from college days. And so we went out and we did interviews with the mayors of the various towns in Story County. For one thing, he knew something about the town. He talked to them about, we went to Kelly. He knew about the phone booth in Kelly, which is, I learned, legendary, and thousands of people of that time went to Kelly to get their picture taken in the phone booth. And each town had something special and something that it was really proud of and a spirit. And I thought, I lived in Story County for 50 years and I never knew anything about this. And the other thing is that each town had a historical society. They valued their history. And thinking back on it now, the interviews that we got were really pieces of history. For example, the outstanding one is the Boone Scenic Valley Railway. They have a wonderful museum. It was donated largely with funds from a man named James H. Andrew. So we went over to James H. Andrew's house, where he still had a lot of railroad paraphernalia. And Paul interviewed him, and he told how his family had come to Iowa, not in a covered wagon, but in a boxcar. They brought their household goods and their animals, and they lived on this boxcar as they traveled, and, you know, traded with the crew on the train. They brought them eggs and fresh eggs from their hens, and how he collected all these railroad things. When, you know, when railroads gradually would get rid of a certain kind of implement, they'd pick it up. And so we were doing history just by doing our programs. And history is everywhere. And the more you know about it, the more interesting your life is.
Well, Susan, we're getting to the end of our time. It's been a great day. And I really think that it was very illuminating to have the people involved with 1619 on. And I didn't realize until just now how well-traveled Gina is. That's amazing.
Well, been a couple places.
You have been listening to Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. And your hosts for today have been Gina McAndrews, Susan Franzen, and special guest host Paul Wilson. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m. You can also hear today's program online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program.
KHOI provides a platform for citizen and public officials to air opinions and information. The views of our guests do not necessarily reflect those of KHOI. KHOI is a community, nonprofit, nonpartisan media.
Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Other voices you heard were Amy Rutenberg and Brian Benkin. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org.
That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member. Or please renew your membership today. All you have to do is hit the yellow Become a Member Donate button. If you enjoyed the show, please tell your friends. And remember, your participation as a listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.